You are listening to WORT 89.9 FM Madison. Next up, a few minutes of the BBC, followed by A Public Affair.
BBC News, I'm John Shea. Democrats in Congress have been grilling top security officials on how planned airstrikes in Yemen came to be discussed in an unsecured group chat that included a prominent journalist. The head of National Intelligence, Tulsi Gabbard, told the House Intelligence Committee that adding the magazine's editor to the chat was a mistake, but maintained the messages were just a policy discussion. Here's Gary O'Donoghue in Washington.
This administration and these individuals within this administration, they have a playbook, and that is that you deny, you deflect, you attack, you downplay, you do everything except acknowledge a weakness or a point from the other side. In many ways, in this case, they have to continue to do that because there are so many senior people involved in this situation. Hugely important. I mean, the very top of the national security establishment. Now, if one is acknowledged to have done wrong and has to go, then, you know, that would call into question all of them. So they have to hold the line politically.
Brazil's Supreme Court has ordered the former president, Jair Bolsonaro, should stand trial for allegedly plotting a military coup. He denies trying to block his successor, President Lula, from taking office after he lost the election in 2022. Rory Gallimore reports.
The decision was unanimous. All five Supreme Court justices said there was enough evidence for the case against the former president and seven of his allies to go ahead. For Mr. Bolsonaro, the ruling can hardly be a surprise. The panel of judges was led by one of his staunchest opponents and embodies the establishment he claims to fight against. The trial could begin later this year. It will focus on Mr. Bolsonaro's refusal to acknowledge his election defeat, which culminated in thousands of his supporters storming government buildings.
Sudan's military leader has visited the presidential palace in Khartoum after landing at the international airport, which has just been recaptured by the army. The airport had been held by the rival paramilitary's rapid support forces for almost 2 years. Barbara Platosher is in Port Sudan.
The army's advanced swiftly since recapturing the presidential palace in the heart of the city last week. Today, it secured the airport, which is also in the city centre, and says it's very close to establishing full control of Khartoum. It's a major victory for the military-led government, which was forced to move to Port Sudan miles away for most of the war. The focus of fighting is now expected to shift to Darfur in the west. The RSF controls most of the vast region, as well as some areas in the south of the country.
The local council in Istanbul has elected an interim mayor to serve in place of Ekrem İmamoğlu, whose detention a week ago triggered huge protests. Nuri Aslan is from Mr. İmamoğlu's centre-left party, the CHP, which serves as the main opposition to President Erdogan's AKP at national level. World News from the BBC. The French President Emmanuel Macron is meeting Volodymyr Zelensky in Paris to discuss the situation in Ukraine. Mr. Zelensky will also take part in a summit of European leaders on Thursday. Earlier, he said that Moscow was not interested in real peace after Russian forces launched more than 100 drones at Ukrainian targets overnight. The British government has announced a squeeze on public spending in the year ahead, mainly on welfare, as growth forecasts for the economy have been halved. In its latest update, the Independent Office for Budget Responsibility predicted that the British economy would grow by only 1% in 2025. For a second day, a number of people in Gaza have protested against Hamas and the continuing war. It comes as the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has warned Hamas that Israel will intensify its pressure if Hamas fails to release the remaining hostages in Gaza. Our Middle East regional editor Sebastian Usher reports from Jerusalem.
Around 100 Palestinians in the Shujaya district of Gaza City proclaimed their defiance of Hamas. We want Hamas to leave us alone and hand over authority to anyone who follows God's will, one man shouted. The protest lasted about 25 minutes. There were fewer participants than in Beit Lahia on Tuesday. The protesters also expressed their fury at Israel and the international failure to stop the war and their anguish at all the loss and destruction they've suffered. In Israel, Benjamin Netanyahu has threatened more extreme measures if Hamas doesn't hand over all the hostages.
The Israeli billionaire industrialist and former politician Steph Wertheimer has died aged 98. He was the founder in the 1950s of what became the multinational toolmaker Iskar. He remained its principal shareholder for five decades. Mr. Wertheimer served in the Knesset as a centrist and was known for his philanthropy. BBC News.
Do you care about workers and labor issues? Do you want to make a difference in our community for working people? Then join the Labor Radio team. Labor Radio is a weekly show that covers labor, social justice, and political issues that impact workers. And we need your help. As a Labor Radio volunteer, you will have the opportunity to report on important labor and social justice stories in your community, interview workers, activists, and experts, produce and edit your own stories. No prior experience is necessary, though a connection with labor is a plus. We will provide training and support. All you need is a passion for worker justice and a desire to amplify the voices of working people. To learn more, contact Volunteer Coordinator Adrian Rainey at 608-321-9583 or head online to WORTFM.org/volunteer to fill out an application. Labor Radio, a voice for workers.
6'6" above sea level. I grab the mic because I like to take you to another mental level. Low power frequency radio modulation. The big sound from underground.
Good afternoon, Madison. You are listening to WORT 89.9 FM. I'm your host, Ali Muldrow. This is A Public Affair. And today we're talking with Annie Menzel, who is a political theorist, a former midwife. Her work focuses on understanding how white supremacy, colonization, and gender-based oppression shape human reproductive life, health, and care. We're talking about her book, Fatal Denial, Racism and the Political Life of Black Infant Mortality. Annie, how are you doing today? I also want to mention she's a tenured professor at the University of Madison, Wisconsin, and my dear, dear friend. Love you so much. I'm so glad that I get to talk about this book with you.
Oh, thank you so much, Ali. I love you so much, too. I love that our kiddos are good friends. And yeah, and that I like literally live a, you know, professional pitcher's stone's throw away from each other.
Yes.
I'm just like, my chest has effervescent bubbling energy in it that I'm sitting here and talking to you about something that is such a core concern and is also linked with abortion and the work that we do and that you so brilliantly lead with the Wisconsin Abortion Fund. And I know we're going to get a chance to talk about some of those connections later on in the interview. I'm healthy, I'm well. My daughter is healthy and well. My mom is healthy and well. And I am just really feeling so grateful to be deepening into connection with dear, dear friends right now in this moment. But I feel like that question is always like a question of scales or concentric circles. And so I'm really worried about a lot of things as well, and particularly those folks with specific vulnerabilities that the current administration is targeting. So our non-citizen students and colleagues on campus and our queer and trans kin. My book really is about the ways that the U.S.'s environment of racism and coloniality has endangered Black infant life, and the ways that the polity has deflected and disavowed responsibility for that environment. And so just this like onslaught of intensifications of that environment are devastating. So that's a long answer.
I think it's like the answer like we all want to give when it's like, how are you doing? And I love that you talked about like three generations of familial health, like you being well and your mother being well and your daughter being well. And that feels like something to lean into and celebrate. And then also the complexity of this moment and what it means. I'm really grateful to get to be in conversation with you today. And I want to encourage folks who have questions to be in conversation with both of us. The number is 608-256-2001. You are listening to WORT 89.9 FM Madison. My guest today is Annie Menzel. I'm your host, Ali Muldrow. We want your questions. So if you are curious about, you know, infant mortality, maternal mortality, like the implications in terms of healthcare, midwifery, if you want to talk to us about the very real consequences of banning abortion or legislature that is impacting pregnant people right now, we want to hear from you. We've got a lot to say. And I think the other thing I want to mention is, like, you are originally from Texas, right?
Well, I was born on Duwamish land in what's currently called Seattle in Washington State. And my extended family on both sides actually had ended up there by the time I was born there, and also Puyallup lands in Tacoma. And so we made our way kind of in a zigzag to Texas. But yeah, we moved there when I was 10, and I stayed in various parts. I went to UT Austin, which is, you know, has a lot of similarities to UW, but it's hotter, warmer nights for wandering, which is so fun as young people. And then did my midwifery training, well, in Austin I started, and then in El Paso. So really different landscape and kind of both geographically and culturally than College Station, which is the horrible town that I lived in from 10 to 18, and then also different from Austin.
I think I thought about that a lot in terms of, you know, the race analysis that is embraced by this book and what it means to kind of have a perspective that is regionally specific across the United States and, you know, really, really thinking about what informs your ability to write about this and to write about it so beautifully and so well and with such compassion and reverence for the experiences of all kinds of people as it informs this book, but really, you know, Black people, like, and you know, I'm so deeply appreciative of the level of care that this book has towards Black folks. I do have to ask, though, like, as a person who is not Black, as a person who does not identify as a member of the Black community, why was it important to you to write this book?
I mean, it really was. I mean, I'm kind of thinking back to my childhood, and it was my friend Tony Cherian, whose folks were doctors from Kerala and newcomers to, actually, we were an underserved area in Texas. And so his parents were physicians who came under, you know, a visa program for underserved areas of the U.S. And he's a public historian, but he, at 17, I never really learned about slavery in school in Texas. And we were, like, in prime cotton growing, like, plantation economy, you know, and, like, the Brazos River was this, like, had a really rich river bottom. And so he took me to this little museum that, of course, we had never visited on field trips. You know, we like, you know, the Alamo is a site where field trips would go. You know, that's a story of white settler, you know, sacrifice and heroism, and all, you know, it's all white dudes, you know, against the sinister Mexican leader. And so, yeah, so Tony, when I was 16 or 17, took me to a museum that featured like real history about enslavement in the Brazos Valley, which is where College Station is. And that real, I'm so grateful to him. And then, like, I am grateful for so many other folks who have shown me, you know, scholars, teachers, and above all, you know, birth workers and birth justice advocates themselves, Black birth workers and birth justice advocates, who have so generously offered their accounts of this history and how the legacies of enslavement and anti-Black racism persist in many of the protocols of, say, you know, over-testing Black mothers and birthing people for drugs, and of course, you know, hyper-criminalization. I will say that a huge event really spurred this project when I was in graduate school, and actually write about it in the book. But I'll just talk through it, which was that. So I was a licensed midwife from 2003 to 2015, even though I didn't practice after 2004. So I spent a lot longer training than I did practicing. But I was part of midwifery organizations. And I was always kind of half committed to graduate school and had kept my foot in the, or like, I don't know, half of me in the midwifery and birth work world. So like I met Tamina Islam, with who I count as one of my, most honored, beloved teachers, who's a midwife here.
She is my midwife.
She was a lead midwife.
At the birth of two of my children.
Yay, yeah. Such a force, of strength and beauty and truth. And I met her at a Wisconsin Guild of Midwives meetings in 2009. So as soon as I started coming here, my daughter's other parent got a job here in 2009. And so I would come here when I was in graduate school. And yeah, so I joined the Guild of Midwives. I was a member of national midwifery organizations. And in 2012, there had been like a lot of tensions erupting at national midwifery conferences because of longstanding racism and tokenization of Black midwives and midwives of color generally among white dominant home birth midwifery organizations. And there in 2012, a group of really like leadership among Black midwives and midwives of color in the Midwives Association of North America, which was kind of the flagship midwifery organization that included nurse midwives that worked in hospitals, but kind of had been founded by white home birth midwives by and large. So in 2012, kind of culminating these dialogues that had consistently ended, in the years previous, in white midwives basically declaring themselves innocent, which is like kind of the key concept of the book, is the white racial innocence, that like, we care about all people, and arguments that will be familiar to anyone who's paid attention to racism, and particularly like white women-led reproductive rights organizations. I don't know. This might sound familiar to you, Ali. I don't know.
It's part of the reason why I asked the question is because I think it's so easy to say you're white and this is not your story to tell. And I think what people would miss in saying that to you is that you're not really telling the story of Black people. You are really telling the story of what white people have done to Black people. And I'm a person who says, slavery is not Black history. Slavery is white history. Slavery tells you what white people are willing to do to other people. Yeah. It doesn't tell you anything about Black people, right? And so in some ways, I think this book, as deeply painful as it is, felt like kind of a relief to read, your voice saying, hey, white people need to own what they've perpetrated against Black women and Black children and Black people throughout history. And we need to be responsible and not defensive and not make excuses, but understand that the impact we've had on the Black community has been devastating and intentional for generations. And it felt courageous to see you own that, because there is that dynamic of like, I think it's amazing how often I'm talking about racism and white folks will want the conversation to be about them, about their feelings, about how good they are, about how they didn't do that, about how the people in their family were somehow exempt from the greater culture. This book doesn't seem to take the easy way out on any front. And I did wonder what it was like for you to hold yourself to that standard and to model that to other white people proactively through this text.
So I'm just going to pick up because I like a signature of mine is I like never get to the punchline of my stories, or it takes like quite a long time. Like you got to ride the riptide out and then come back to the beach. So in 2012, as I was saying, so this leading group of midwives resigned from the Midwives Association of North America, and to which I belonged at the time. And there was a group that formed in the wake of that resignation called Anti-Racism and Anti-Oppression in Midwifery, that was in dialogue with some of these midwives who had resigned. And then also it was a predominantly, although it was a multiracial group, predominantly white midwives who really were just like wrote a letter of support to these midwives. And we were like, yeah, this is not the organization that we want to be or need to be, or that really needs to be a formation that's still committing these harms and denying them. And so we wrote, quote, that white midwives' failure to acknowledge this history of racism, of its own institutional racism, while laying claim to, quote, traditional knowledge from the 1970s onward, is an act of violence, erasing midwives of color from the past and creating an innocent present for white dominant midwifery. So we wrote that in 2012. And even though only one of the chapters in this book is really focused on midwifery, and it's on Black midwives in the Jim Crow South and their kind of conscription into a regime of state surveillance, and often, you know, threatened or actual criminalization for continuing to practice their own, you know, lineages of vernacular care and herbalism and other, you know, ways of knowing and practicing. So it's, you know, that's one chapter here, that moment, and even like coming back to that phrasing, which I didn't even remember until I looked at it again, of innocence, kind of was a real seed. And so also like there's a long lineage of white scholars writing about Black infant mortality, some of whom I profile in the book, and they presume this politics of knowledge that situates themselves as objective and normative diagnosticians separate from and superior to, you know, Black communities and Black infants and Black mothers, you know, as deviant and damaged and as the real, but like objects under the microscope of their analyses. And so in that book, and it, honestly, Ali, my dissertation was not clear on my approach as a white person. And so part of the reason it took me so long to like, turn, I mean, I honestly only have 60 pages of the dissertation in this book, so it was pretty much a total rewrite. But I really grappled with being a white person writing about Black infant death, you know, and especially as, you know, when the year that I, you know, the Black Lives Matter movement was taking off precisely because the police murders of Black children, you know, right around the time I finished my dissertation. And so, you know, I got a lot of rigorous feedback from my wonderful students at Vassar in my first job, and also from colleagues that really, and one of my readers, Dr. Juliet Hooker at Brown University, who really, you know, gave me super generous, but also critical feedback about, you know, about really centering Black mothers in particular, their loss and grief in a way that, you know, wasn't, that really honored it, that didn't take it as my own story, but that also didn't replicate the dynamics that I was talking about, you know, of kind of some kind of outside observer. And so what I did is I really attempted to reverse that diagnostic lens, really to diagnose the political mechanisms of denial and deflection within that lineage of scholarship and study of Black infant mortality. Even as, especially in recent years, there are lots of, you know, attestations of, to the contrary, you know, that, oh, no, we are really trying to help and we're listening to community, et cetera, doing what a leading doula of, I'm blanking, based in Missouri, Hakima Tafunzi Payne draws on this phrasing that fellow doula Sherry White created called disparities pimping. I don't know if you picked up on that, but that was kind of the, that, you know, so Hakima also was one of my teachers in calling my attention to this. So I really am trying to diagnose white expertise and authority in ways that they have enabled the continued endangerment of Black pregnant people and infants while preserving white dominance along with misogyny, ableism, class oppression. And that dynamic of like deflecting blame onto Black communities themselves, especially mothers and birthing people and midwives historically, and that's like resurging in intriguing ways in this moment where people are looking to Black doulas in particular as a kind of silver bullet. But this like dynamic of diagnosis of deviance, deflection of blame, I call that the biopolitics of racial innocence in this book. So that was kind of like how I came around to feeling like I could write this book in an ethical way that, and that really uplifts also, as I do in my final chapter and my and throughout in some ways, but especially in my introduction and final chapter, the birth justice movement led by Black, Indigenous, and Latine birth workers.
It reminds me of this I can't remember who says it, but this saying that's like, if you write about me, make sure you write about you too, because at least that way we know half of it's true, right? It felt like, you know, if you're going to talk about, a lot of times, you know, I think the disparities pimping is such a keen insight into the phenomena of thinking that the conditions of Black America are indicators of what's wrong with Black people versus evidence of what white folks have done to, exactly, to the Black community. And this book, exactly, really challenges that notion within the context of motherhood, which feels so incredibly empowering for me as a Black woman, because I think Black women are under this like constant attack in terms of how we parent and how we love and who we are and why our kids are always the kids. All of that dynamic is so brutal and constant, and this book alleviates it in a lot of ways and interrogates the people who perpetrate it. And there was something deeply liberating about getting to read it because of that. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to A Public Affair on WORT 89.9 FM Madison. My guest today is Annie Menzel. If you have any questions, give us a call. The number is 608-256-2001. Before we really get back into the conversation about this amazing book, Fatal Denial, Racism, and the Political Life of Black Infant Mortality, I want to give a huge shout out to our team. So thank you so much to Jay and Sarah and Shally and Lainey for, you know, making this show possible, making sure that we're on the air. You all are the key ingredient to what I get to do every Wednesday on WORT. Could not do this show without you. Thank you so much, y'all. For, you know, allowing me to have conversations like this and to talk about a book that is as feminist and important as this book is. Annie, I've got a lot of questions for you. And I'm feeling now that I need to be selective. You know, I'm just going to dive into the abortion conversation. As abortion becomes less and less accessible across the country, it seems strange that the anti-abortion movement hasn't focused more on infant mortality and maternal mortality. Like, if folks are really pro-life, why hasn't infant mortality and maternal mortality been what they have been talking about all along. Why abortion as the focus rather than quality healthcare? I think there's some missing pieces to the conversation. Do you think your book can serve as a reminder that pregnancy and birth come with complications and abortion is compassion mm-hmm. in many instances?
Mm-hmm. Well, first, I just want to go back for a little bit and just thank you so much for sharing your experience and that testimony. I just really appreciate that generosity so much. My heart is with yours. So thank you. And I know I can't swear on air. So curses on all forces that have ever made you and every Black mother and parent feel that the problem was theirs rather than with the surrounding white supremacist, colonial, misogynist society.
Thank you.
So I will say for folks, I think it's so important to say that legal, incredible, incredible legal scholar Michelle Bratcher Goodwin has been really fire in making these connections between abortion access and the larger picture of infant and maternal mortality, which honestly, on a global scale, even for white babies and mothers and birthing people in this country, despite a kind of, you know, U.S. exceptionalist, you know, superior sense of it, you know, superiority complex, are not at all, not even close to the standard that that humans should have and can have, as we see demonstrated in statistics, although, as I talk about in the book, statistics are at least a double-edged sword. But Japan, Singapore, Anguilla, France are among the, I don't know if it's 40 plus, you know, countries that have better infant mortality statistics than
white. So the United States is 43rd in the world.
Yeah.
So there are 42 places where you can give birth and you and your child are more likely to survive, and they are outside of the United States.
Exactly. And then if you differentiate that, you know, and look at, you know, Black and Indigenous birthing people and their infant survival, you know, it just becomes so clear that it is the conditions. It's the conditions of pregnancy and birth that are really the determining factors. Okay, sorry, that was a little detoured. So Michelle Goodwin and Dorothy Roberts, the like legendary Black feminist legal scholar, Dorothy Roberts, they've just always been making these connections. And then of course, the reproductive justice movement is making these connections between the fact that forced pregnancy period under anti-abortion restrictions is itself a violation of core human rights and human dignity. And that really, like, life itself, life as this interconnected, you know, phenomenon that unites us all as humans and with all other beings on earth, forced pregnancy is a form of violence. And then if you add to that the fact, you know, the really egregious inequities, the egregious and externally determined inequities that particularly endanger Black and Indigenous birthing people in this country, it's not only forced pregnancy, as if that were enough of a violation, you know, as if that were not enough of a violation, but it's actually endangering the lives of birthing people and their children, you know, building. So adding on to this long legacy of the U.S. as a toxic environment, you know, in many ways, given legal, cultural norms, you know, medical protocols of violence and neglect, and then just the thoroughgoing ways that racism and colonialism are built into our very environment, our schooling, you know, our every single institution, you know? And so I think making those connections, you know, Loretta Russ made them in a recent article that I read and can't call to mind, but I just think keeping those connections. So I guess for me, the anti-abortion folks clearly, and I think they're even just saying it more and more plainly, what they care about are what in the book I call the true baby. You know, this cult of true babyhood, which is the white, cherubic, you know, typically abled baby, you know, ensconced in white bourgeois, you know, maternal embrace within the domestic realm, you know, within a patriarchal domestic order. And that is the baby that is the heart, that's the, it's the implicit normative standard for measuring like infant health. And I think that's one of the, it's actually one of the like ways that the US's superiority complex about our healthcare system is so, has such a grip, because like this white baby, that's the, both the kind of avatar of US white racial innocence and also the embodiment of the white national future. I mean, we are seeing this in the rise of, you know, trad wives and right wing, you know, kind of icon, re-iconization of a nostalgic, you know, maternity that's, you know, back in the homestead, back in the, and back in a kind of like enthusiastic subservience to patriarchal power.
No, and I do think like one of the things that makes this moment really interesting and deeply divisive racially is the nostalgia of yes. the moment. And I'm like, I don't meet a lot of Black women who really long for the 1950s, right?
Hello.
How Black women were situated. Yeah. And I think a lot of times the question is, well, when should a person be able to get an abortion? When should a person, at what point in pregnancy should a person not be able to get an abortion? And I always reframe that question to, at what point in pregnancy does the pregnant person become a breeding animal, a tool for birth, right? We're no longer their body matters, their decisions yeah. matter. We're going to rob them of any say or any autonomy because they are this pregnant and therefore they don't have decision-making power anymore.
Right.
Well, that's the real question about that's when right. should you or should you not be able to make certain decisions that that's may right. or may not impact your health and the health of the child that you're carrying.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. You're still talking.
So, I mean, I do want to say though, I think the question is about, you know, abortion and what your book means. You know, and I was in a conversation recently where a person who proclaimed that they were pro-life started to cry when somebody used the term abortion care. And about a half an hour later, a person came and gave a presentation and said, hey, in the state of Wisconsin, Black women are far more likely to die. Black children are far more likely to die during birth. And that same person who was crying about the term abortion care treated the idea that me and my children are more likely to die like it was a fun fact. You know, I'm talking about the driest eyes I've ever seen.
Wow.
And so that disconnect for me has been something I've been really trying to understand, is how can you be really passionately pro-life when it comes to abortion and not at all concerned about addressing infant mortality yes. and maternal mortality.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Do you think your book kind of sheds light on, you know, if you're pro-life, then maybe you want to do something about infant mortality and maternal mortality?
I mean, honestly, I really do think that this ongoing kind of like rooted in the 19th century, but also engendered by centuries of enslavement, this kind of fetishization of white, typically abled infancy is like, it really translates to like the fascist, I'm not going to say it, I don't know all 14 words, but like one of the fascist mottos is like to secure a future for white children, you know? And it feels very naked in this moment that that's the concern. And so I think, you know, from that vantage, it's a absolute atrocity that this disconnect obtains, but it also makes horrific sense, you know. And I want to say that the other thing that I think, if we're thinking about being on the side of life, I mean, I don't think we can reclaim pro-life, but on the side of life, I think a thing that this book really showed me, and I think also I have to thank my, colleagues in Indigenous studies and settler colonial studies for really pushing me on this, from, kind of the dissertation to the book, is that to really understand that I can't understand that none of us can understand anti-Black racism without understanding the colonial genocides and attempted genocides that made the land available for enslavement to be a thing, and that those displacements, those deliberate disconnections of Indigenous peoples from lands and waters that endangered, Native nations themselves, instituted a regime of literal dehumanization, legal dehumanization, and the utter violation of kinship among Black folk. Although of course they made kin, and engaged in the most astounding survival practices day to day. And, I'm drawing on a long lineage of Black feminist work on this from Angela Davis, and even going back to, of these, daily survival practices of ensuring to the best that they could their children's and community's survival. But, that it's all connected. And so I think it's so important to acknowledge what Ruha Benjamin, says, vampirically, white vitality feeds on Black demise. And I think that is a huge and crucial understanding. And what the forces that are killing and endangering Black infant survival are the same forces that threaten all life.
Yeah, no, it's an amazing thing to think that the tools that were used to torture Black women in a barn, right, are still the tools that obstetrics are relying on today, that literally the oppression of Black women has informed what birth is like and what gynecological, exams
exactly.
are for everyone.
Exactly, exactly. And I think, so Dorothy Roberts has this incredible phrase, and I'm not going to say it exactly right, but basically she said it was the objectification and separation, this is the gist, of the Black mother from her infant as two separate commodities that made thinkable the destruction of the maternal infant bond. And so we see, exactly as Deirdre Cooper Owens, the Black feminist historian who really, really kind of, is not the first person to write about J. Marion Sims and the origins of obstetrics, but is, such an important contributor to that. She talks about the development of the speculum, for instance, but also that the ways that obstetrics and gynecology really are rooted in this situation of total domination. I do think, and I also want to say, I know some incredible obstetricians and gynecologists, so this isn't about individual people, but I do think structurally, the kind of forced protocols of hospital birth and the physician is kind of ultimate authority over that life and death process, and their deliberate separation from any kind of community support, which was their ideal of kind of when hospital birth got instituted, even for elite white women, I think is rooted in those origins. Of course, you know, it impacts white women, you know, at different intensities and kind of degrees of brutality. But the birthplace lab, so that Saraswati Vedam and Monica McLemore and other collaborators, the birthplace lab found just a couple of years ago, 1 out of 6, and the population was cis women, 1 out of 6 birthing women report abuse during birth. 1 out of 6 across the board. And then of course it's intensified. Most intensified for Indigenous women, but also Black women, Latina women, and Asian American women. And so, but 1 out of 6, 1 out of 10 is too many. You know, I mean, it's just like mind-boggling. And so those protocols have just routinized, you know.
Well, and it's interesting to think about how many women report abuse during birth. How many women experience level of abuse. And I think about just the way, you know, when you say, oh, it's about like domination, I think about the image that we've created in media of like a woman giving birth and people yelling at her to push, like that you need to be told what to do and micromanaged through your entire labor and physical experience, that there is no interest in like trusting the person who is pregnant, the person who is giving birth, to have any relationship to how they want to give birth or what they should be doing with their body. The idea that like, you're unqualified, you're less than an expert, and your experience needs to be dictated to you because I know what's best for you. And that positionality towards women and how that informs the way we relate to abortion, the way we relate to parenting, the expectations we have of women. We don't have a ton of time left. I'm kind of amazed at how fast this hour has gone, Annie. I just want to remind people, the book is called Fatal Denial, Racism, and the Political Life of Black Infant Mortality. We're talking to Annie Menzel. You're listening to WORT 89.9 FM. I'm your host, Sally Muldrow, and this is A Public Affair. Annie, I wanted to ask you to just kind of read a snippet of your book to our audience so people can know kind of what they're getting into when they join our very, very feminist book club. Me and Sarah have been on a really nice roll the last couple of weeks. So if you want to, you know, you want to get a little radical and think about care and take into consideration a different perspective, you should read this book.
Well, I wanted to start with my acknowledgments, the first paragraph of the acknowledgments. So the political visions, analyses, and care practices of midwives, doulas, birth workers, physicians, and organizers working for justice in birth set the coordinates for this book. For my understanding of birth justice, as well as its breadth and power, I'm particularly indebted to the work of Black Women Birthing Justice, the Southern Birth Justice Network, Tewa Women United, the Black Mamas Matter Alliance, Ancient Song Doula Services, visionary leading midwife Jenny Joseph, founder of the first Black-owned midwifery school in the U.S. in Florida, Elephant Circle, Rashad Tahani Lawler Queen, Tamina Islam, Tia Murray, Tamara Tams Thompson, Mikaela Berry Smith, Hakima Tifunzi Payne, Marina Farrell, Catherine Hall Trujillo, Claudia Booker, Alexis Pauline Gums, Carmen Mojica, Indra Lucero Esquire, Paula X. Rojas, Micaela Cadena, Liam Colley, Jackson Darling, Wendy Gordon, Marika Van Ruyen, Kristen Eflin, Jeanette McCulloch, Vivian Gutierrez, Wikampi Iyotun Nguyen, Monica McLemore, Karen Scott, Dr. Karen Scott, the radical OB, Monica Bazile, Sheree Suzette Bergeron, Sarah Davis, Heather Sinclair, Devorah Herman, Ruth Kaufman, Ashley Hartman Annis, Natalie Lake, Deb Cayley, and Gretchen Spicer. And if I would add now Chandra Lewis of Harambe Village Doulas, director of doula of programming at Harambe Village. And also profound thanks to sociologist Keisha Good, whose work on racism in US midwifery and Black midwives' relation to reproductive justice is so crucial in her first coming book. And also my really dear friend, mentor, you know, scholar that I really look to, who coined the term obstetric racism, has been just a key interlocutor for this book. So that's the most important part, but I do have another small passage to read if you would so allow, but
I'd love you to, please.
Okay. So this is from the last chapter and kind of the concluding section. Every new human being, the human being that carries it, and the beings that sustain this miraculous and unique unfolding of life are part of a vast and delicate ecology, at once exquisitely responsive to local conditions and linked through air, water, minerals, histories, and systems to all other beings on Earth. For James Baldwin, who concentrated on the US polity, racial innocence was precisely the mechanism by which US whites denied these material bonds and refused to acknowledge, let alone redress, the histories that had created their deadly current configuration. At a planetary level too, such disavowal permits the massive everyday predation, theft, and hoarding that underpin the cult of true babyhood today. The system of sacrifice demanded, as M. Murphy describes it, by, quote, rich, white, settler, colonial, heteronormative reproduction, baby making with expensive strollers assembled in supply chain capitalist webs, fossil fuel guzzling SUVs fed through pipelines, oil turned into piles of plastic toys destined for landfills, and then microplastic gyres, all the many forms of white possession and enablement. Within this context, the stories that infant mortality statistics tell are not self-evident. Under US colonial racial capitalism, they've been used time and again to tell a self-aggrandizing story of white biological and moral supremacy and Black maternal, family, and community pathology, and as an apology for colonial and racial capitalist violence that robs from and poisons the ecology of Black infant life. They have deflected official attention from the life-giving elements of that ecology gathered by Black maternity, paternity, kinship, midwifery, care, and collective life around Black infancy and survival. Can I read a little bit more, or is there... Should I stop?
Yeah, I would say you've got about another 40 seconds. What can you?
All right. When Black infant mortality entered public view in the late 19th century, it did so as a part of a broader condemnation of blackness, to use Khalil Gibran Muhammad's phrasing. And you know, statisticians and experts at the time, they argued that Black infant mortality rate signaled the evolutionary inferiority of a dying race. And I just wanted to lift up basically that W.E.B. Du Bois and Mary Church Terrell, whom I each feature in a chapter, they were always contesting this rationalization, as were Black parents and communities themselves. And so I just wanted to, birth workers and that constituted a really robust and crucial lineage of protection for Black infant life that now, the birth justice movement is carrying forward.
Oh, thank you so much for reading that. Thank you so much for writing that. One of the things I think that happens to me when I read a book like yours, or like the book I read last week, is that I wish I had read it when I was 20 and before I had three children and before a series of things, informed my reality in ways that were harmful to me. And so my hope is that your book is really reaching younger generations of people, that it is reaching, folks who want to be doctors, folks who want to be midwives, folks who don't realize they have this unchecked bias towards the Black community, and want to take care of Black people without understanding how their racism will inform that care. Can you talk to me about who you hope reads this book? And I'm using hope
pretty strategically. Who do you hope reads this book, and what do you hope they take away from it? And we've got just a couple minutes left.
Yeah. Well, it's funny because I've been like, I think that still that apprehension and like the long grappling with how to write it as a white person has also like made me kind of keep it on the down low since it was published. Like I feel weird about, you know, promoting it. But I do like, I feel like I'm like able to shake off some of that. And I really so appreciate your feedback on it and other, you know, there I've been, you know, the folks that I wrote it, whose wisdom was at the center, you know, it's been really precious to continue to be in dialogue with them. So I do, I guess, yes, for white caregivers who want to provide care in alignment with birth justice, I hope that you will read this book. And you know, Dorothy Roberts' book, Keisha Good's book, Gertrude Fraser wrote African American Midwifery in the South. Absolutely crucial book for anyone who wants to do birth care. So I would say, read this book and also, you know, check out the bibliography and the citations and make sure you read all those as well. And maybe do that first, but,
yeah. I feel like that was such a professor answer, was to create an entire list of required to get to this book, but it's a good list of required reading. And here's the thing. You might have a hard time hyping up this book. I don't have that problem at all. I feel that me and my ancestors are very proud of this book, of this work, and really think like white people need to be interrogating themselves and each other. And so as much as I hope younger generations are reading this book, I really hope some older white men who think that they know a lot about abortion and think that they know a lot about pregnancy, yes, get their hands on this book. The book is called Fatal Denial, Racism, and the Politics of Life, the Political Life of Black Infant Mortality. Annie Menzel, I cannot thank you enough for joining me today on WORT 89.9.
So I really appreciate it.
Oh, we are so lucky to be your first interview about this book. And I hope that you have many, many more, because this book is powerful. And what it says is deeply meaningful. And I think when you live in a world that gaslights you about racism and the impact and consequences of racism, to have a white person show up and take responsibility and say, hey, this is Black people are not the problem. We are the problem. We are the ones that are promoting these outcomes. We are the ones that are creating these conditions. And until we change, we are going to continue to be bad for the world, the people around us, and ourselves. And this book says that in a really powerful, deeply evidence-based way. And I'll be grateful for it for a long time. So if you want to join my book club, if you're out there listening to WORT 89.9 FM Madison, I want to remind you, I'm your host, Sully Muldrow. This is a public affair. Grab this book, Fatal Denial, Racism, and the Political Life of Black Infant Mortality. Thank you all for tuning in. Enjoy your Wednesday, my friends.
Disregard the mainstream,
media distorted. We come and listen and support it. Live and direct, we come and never pre-recorded. With information that would never be reported. Disregard the mainstream, media distorted. We come and listen and support it. Live and direct, we come and never pre-recorded. With information that would never be reported. Disregard the mainstream, media distorted. We come and listen and support it. Live and direct, we come and never pre-recorded. With information that would never be reported. Disregard the mainstream, media distorted. We come and listen and support it.
You are listening to WORT 89.9 FM Madison. Next up, a few minutes of the BBC, followed by Letters in Politics.
Yeah. This is Pacifica Radio's Letters on Politics. On today's show, we'll be talking about the first 2 months of the Donald Trump presidency, what his administration has achieved so far, where it may all be going. Our guest is longtime political reporter Ruth Conniff. Ruth Conniff is editor-in-chief of the Wisconsin Examiner. She's also author of the book, Milked, How an American Crisis Brought Together Midwestern Dairy Farmers and Mexican Workers. We'll also take your phone calls and emails. That's next on Letters on Politics. But first, the news.
BBC News, I'm John Shea. Democrats in Congress have been grilling top US security officials on how planned airstrikes in Yemen came to be discussed in an unsecured group chat, which included a prominent journalist. The messages, with precise times for when US warplanes and missiles would be launched, have been published by The Atlantic magazine, after President Trump insisted they were not classified. The Vice President, J.D. Vance, has dismissed the significance of the published transcript. Nomia Iqbal is in Washington.
In an article titled, "Here are the attack plans that Trump's advisers shared on Signal," the journalist...